Regent School of Austin for the previous 8 years, and I have recently been promoted to 8th grade. Only took me 8 years to make it out of 6th grade. And this is storytelling, so make sure that you're in the right place. And since it's storytelling and how that can be applied to the grammar school, I'd like to begin with a story. In the pursuit of immediate pleasure or gratification, quite often prudence and discretion are disregarded, resulting in one becoming ensnared in a potentially perilous situation. This lesson was indelibly imprinted on my mind a number of years ago by the careless and impetuous actions of a skunk on the campus of Regent School of Austin. Now, this was a time when elevated wooden decks adorned the campus of Regents, providing walkways between our portable buildings. A skunk, one of the innumerable creatures abiding underneath the deck, was awakened sometime in the early morning by the aroma of a sweet, fruity concoction, presumably left behind by a student. On the deck lay a mixed berry Yoplait yogurt container. The container rested on its side, the foil covering having been completely torn asunder. There was no barrier to inhibit the aromatic scent from slowly wafting out of the plastic cylinder and descending through the deck into the still, cavernous home of the foul-smelling rodent. The inside of the yogurt was coated with a purplish paste, enough, in fact, to persuade the usually cautious creature to venture into the above-deck world. The world was one filled with danger. And you have to understand that our uniform, the girls wear plaid skirts. This world was one filled with danger, for plaid-clad, boisterous, biped creatures dwelled there. Their high-pitched cackles and giggles, as well as their thundering footfalls, were usually enough to keep the skunk cloistered in the shadows and safety of his deck cave. Yet, the aroma, well, it proved to be too tantalizing in every inhibition and cautious impulse was negated. He would leave his home, and soon the treasure would be his. And so his misadventure began. He cautiously stuck his snout out from under the deck and scented the air. The smell of the plaid bipeds was old and stale. Clearly, they had not arrived. Now was the time. He surreptitiously crept up the wooden stairs, ever vigilant for the slightest hint of movement or the faintest sound that might indicate a threat to his life. He paused on the top step. His senses were rapidly processing data. All appeared to be safe. He was exposed, and exposure meant possible peril. The longer he was topside, the greater the likelihood of him encountering an enemy. He briefly thought about going back down, but at just that moment, an odoriferous cloud from the container seemed to blanket his entire head. He could almost taste the sugary ambrosia, temptation seizing hold of his desire, put an end to all notions of going back under the deck. With a lick and a faintly audible smack, he waddled toward the yogurt. When he was only inches away, he stooped low and peered inside. At least 5 good licks were his estimate. With his nostrils dilated and a glint of pride briefly shimmering in his eyes, if only the raccoon could see him now. Salivating as only a skunk can, he thrust his head through the opening of the yogurt container, which had a diameter just large enough for his entire head to pass through. Once inside, he realized that his lick estimate had been incorrect. There were clearly 7 full savory licks. His tongue went to work, scrubbing and rubbing in every conceivable direction until the container was licked clean. If a skunk is capable of a smug smile, this is when it occurred. "Where is the coon?" he thought to himself in a moment of pride. Now, he had been topside long enough. It was time for his retreat back to his sanctuary. But as the striped mammal attempted to back his head out of the container, he was suddenly overwhelmed with a feeling of panic. His head was stuck. When his head entered the container, the hair on his neck laid flat. But when he attempted to reverse his way out of the cylinder, that same hair was caught and lifted up by the inside of the yogurt container. His own hair was acting as a virtual fur barrier. Suddenly, the rate of his palpitations and breathing increased. He erratically swung his head from the left to the right in the negative, and then up and down in the affirmative. Then he shook his head as a dog might after a bath. But all these attempts at dislodging the container were futile. It was securely planted on his head. Now you must remember that a skunk relies on its keen senses of sight and sound in order to detect the potential approach of an enemy. But now, his vision was totally eclipsed, and all sounds from the outside world were distorted and indistinguishable from the echoes of his own rapidly beating heart and breathing. He was blind and exposed. An easy target. He began to bemoan the folly of his adventure, but he soon realized that this was neither the place nor the time to reflect on his imprudent behavior. He had to get off the deck, for the bipeds would be arriving soon, and he would be at their mercy. He tilted the yogurt container up at about a 45-degree angle in a vain attempt to scent the air, and began to inch toward what he thought might be the direction of the stairway that would lead to the ground and to safety. After 3 steps, he was stopped by a dull jolt. He had run into one of the portable buildings. The bottom of the plastic container quickly slid toward him and was soon thrust upon his snout, compressing his nose into the size of a raisin. He whimpered in pain and then released a growl of frustration as he realized that the container was now lodged even more firmly upon his head. Pain, fear, and embarrassment were woven together in a fabric of emotion that he had never before experienced. The only solace was that the raccoon was not present. This was it. He knew this would be his demise. Unable to run away, he would soon be captured, perhaps by the plaid-clad bipeds, or worse, maybe he wouldn't be noticed and would slowly die from dehydration. His head encased in a plastic sarcophagus, filled with an odor that no longer titillated his senses, but had become revolting. The deck began to rumble. He couldn't ascertain from what direction the rumble came, but he instinctively knew that something rather large was approaching. I arrived at school before any of the teachers. It was October. The first cool front of the season had blown through the previous evening. The air was crisp, tinged with a subtle chill, very unusual for Texas. I paused on the deck adjacent to my room and glanced about, enjoying the invigorating summer mountain-like temperature. The deck, the oak trees, the portable buildings seemed almost iridescent, faintly glowing in the early morning sun. movement. I was startled. I thought I saw something black and white on the deck across the courtyard. Cat, probably. But the stripe running down its back, it could only indicate one thing. We had a skunk. I was perplexed. Why was it on the deck? Surely it heard my approach. Rabid. That must be it. Only rabies would cause such a normally skittish animal to act so strangely. Now, students would be arriving soon. I needed a plan. I needed a weapon. The broom in my room, it would have to do. I dropped my bag, unlocked the door, and grabbed the broom in one fluid movement. I twirled the broom, creating two clockwise circles in the air. This was war. Combat. Teacher versus disease-infected, demented rodent. I had to be quick. I had to have my wits about me. What was I supposed to look for? Ah, yes. The vertical tail. When it stands upright, he's about to fire. I rounded the corner of the deck with a confident, weighing gait. I was the Duke. It was just like the Old West. The lawman facing the threat on a wooden deck, each armed with a weapon. It was my job to protect the innocent, in this case, the children, from such a vile threat. And protect I would. But as I faced the enemy, I realized that something was amiss. There, not 20 feet in front of me, was a skunk with some type of container on its head. The container was slowly pivoting back and forth in the motion of a metronome. And then the motion stopped. He must have heard me because he then tilted up the container and his head at an oblique angle and froze. Peals of laughter soon emanated from deep inside. I never perceived nor conceived of something of such hilarity as that which was before me. A skunk with a yogurt container firmly affixed upon its head. I knew then and there that I was not dealing with a rabid animal. Maybe foolish, but not infected with any type of brain ravaging malady. This would be easy. I would simply pry off the container with a broom handle, and once free, the skunk would scurry back to his home beneath the deck. And I would start my day an unscented hero, savior of the rodent, as well as defender of the grammar school. But it was not to be. For I did lodge the end of the broom handle under the opening of the container, but try as I might, I could not get it off. I attempted to pry the container off, but only managed to stretch the skunk's neck, as well as causing him to stumble a few inches forward. After three unsuccessful maneuvers to liberate the animal, I decided to give the poor creature's neck a rest, and I sought reinforcements at headquarters being our main office. Our head of school was fortunately in his office. I briefed him on the situation, and he soon returned with me, armed with a garden rake. He apprehensively approached the agitated animal and secured one of the teeth of the garden rake inside the opening of the container. He also wrestled with the skunk, but this time the skunk fought back with an opposing pull. There they were, swaying back and forth on the deck, tug of war between man and blind animal. After seven consecutive tugs, there was a pop. Liberation. The yogurt container landed and erratically rolled across the deck until it was halted by the railing. The dumbfounded skunk stood momentarily stupefied. He was obviously mesmerized to be in such proximity to two bipeds. After glancing at the head of school, and then at me, he quietly and nonchalantly made his escape back to his sub-deck refuge. Now, I begin our session today by telling you a story, a technique commonly employed by pastors, teachers, as well as professional speakers. The technique is frequently used because it works so well. The technique works so well because it grabs one's attention and provides a framework, a filing cabinet, or a skeleton for one to put facts or ideas on. In short, it gives structure to knowledge. And this structure helps one recall the knowledge at some later point in time. Now imagine that I was working with teenage males, and I was trying to convey to them the dire consequences of sexual immorality. I'm speaking to raging hormone containers. How do I communicate to them the importance of avoiding promiscuous activities? I could share with them a number of scriptures, but would it also not be of great benefit if I was able to provide them with a story to illustrate the idea of what can happen if we disregard what we know to be right just for a moment of pleasure? If I told them the story of the skunk, which knew it was perilous to venture onto the deck in broad daylight, but did it for instant gratification, and, as a result, got into serious trouble and could have conceivably lost his life, do you think they would soon forget the image of a disoriented skunk, blinded by a yogurt container, stumbling around in the darkness? I think not. And after the story, I could share scriptures with them and point out when someone radically departs from the precepts of God, he endangers himself in the very same manner as the skunk. By using a story, I would have caught my reader's attention, my listener's attention, and illustrated my point in a memorable way. That is the power of using a story to enhance your teaching. Think for a moment about Jesus, God incarnate. The immortal becomes one of us. In a sense, he puts skin on and appears as one of us to show and teach us about himself and his kingdom, both of which are the complete antithesis of man and his culture. When he begins his ministry, a substantial part of it is teaching. And what is his preferred method of instruction? Stories. He is constantly illustrating points by using simile, metaphor, and parable. How many times did he state, the kingdom of God is like, and then launch right into a story? Now, why did God, the omniscient one, use stories so frequently in his teaching? I believe it's because he knew that stories would grab and hold his listeners' attention and would provide the structure to hold the ideas that he wanted them to remember. And he also had to find commonality between his infinite mind and the finite mind of man. He taught a new truth by relating it to something already known by the people of the ancient Middle East. That's why he used so many agrarian illustrations. And this is one of the laws that Gregory highlights in his book, The Seven Laws of Learning. Effective teachers naturally do this. They have information about a particular subject, the grammar, if you will, and somehow they must convey this information to a young mind. If it's a new, difficult concept, they must find a connection between the new information or idea that they desire the student to comprehend, and something that the student already understands, or is a part of his everyday experience. Many times they do this by illustration or story. It's like this, or have you ever, or imagine if you were. Now, if God used this teaching method, would we not also be very wise to employ it in our teaching? I do believe we would. So, how does one use storytelling in the classroom? Spontaneous hypotheticals. I coined that cheesy term, so. What are spontaneous hypotheticals? These are stories that you make up as you are teaching to provide deeper understanding. My third year of teaching. I was teaching sixth grade, and it was Bible time. And we had gotten to the chapter in Matthew in which Jesus says, don't worry about what you will eat. Don't worry about what you will wear. The Father knows your needs, but first seek the kingdom of God, and then all these things will be added onto you. We got to that section, and I briefly chatted with one of my sixth graders prior to the day beginning, and I said, when we get to the part about don't worry about what you'll eat and what you will wear, I just want you to begin crying incessantly. And he said, all right, Mr. Williams. So we launch into class, launch into Bible, and I have another student that's reading along. And we get to the portion, and do not worry about what you eat. And there's the student. And the rest of the students, of course, they look over and they say, something is wrong with this, our fellow student. Mr. Williams, you must do something. You are the authority figure here. You are the chief counselor in the classroom. You must attend to the student that is in distress. And so I walked up, and there is the student. I said, his name was Wynn. I said, Wynn, I need you to just control yourself for a minute. I said, Wynn, it's all right. Just breathe. You're in a safe environment. What seems to be the problem?
Williams, I'm just worried about when I get home this afternoon. I don't know if there's going to be any food on the table.
By this time, the kids have started to pick up on it. I said, when? That's kind of an illogical fear to have. Let me ask you a question. Have your parents ever failed to provide you with a nutritious or semi-nutritious meal at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, or 6:30?
Yes. No.
Very good. You know that your parents love you, right?
Yeah.
And they provide for all of your needs, is that correct?
Yeah.
So, is there any reason for you to be this distraught about possibly not having a meal at dinner time?
No.
Fantastic. Can we proceed with the reading? And I say to you, do not worry about what you will wear. When? Please, this is becoming very disruptive. What's the problem now? I thought we took care of the whole worry about what you're going to feast upon this evening. Your parents are going to provide the victuals. Don't worry about it.
Not that, Mr. W.
Okay, Wynn. What's the problem now?
I need some new socks. I have holes in them, and I just don't know if Mom's going to procure me some this time.
Wynn, let's review the logic that we just went over. Have you ever gone to school naked?
No.
Have you ever worn a potato sack?
I don't think so.
When is there any reason to have this type of fear that your parents will not properly adorn you with clothing?
No.
When? Let's calm down. And of course, that's a spontaneous hypothetical. You kind of make it on the spot. Now, creating spontaneous hypotheticals come with experience. When I first began teaching, I was very hesitant to leave the safety of my podium. The reason being, because that was the resting place of my outline. And my outline directed and triggered my thoughts. Without it, I was lost. This was no man's land. That was my refuge. And so this made my teaching quite almost robotic, stunted, pedantic. It wasn't anything to really engage the children's mind. Now, I'm not an advocate that teaching has to be entertainment. One of my favorite books is Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death. If you have not read that, I charge you with reading that. But neither should teaching be inherently dry because the instructor has not put forth the time to think about a particular lesson. Teaching is an art. It is a craft developed over time. And this is a hard lesson that I have had to learn. One does not become an excellent teacher overnight. It takes time and immense practice. I know a lot of people, they'll teach for a year or two, and then they'll just throw up their hands, I just don't have it, I don't have the gift. Well, do we say that in any other professions? We typically don't. First year of medical school, I just don't have the gift. You know, I can't hold a scalpel. No. And how many of you have had the experience when you look back on your year and you say, good golly, why did I do that? Or you look back on your first year of teaching, what did those children learn? What was I thinking? It's like a snowball. And as we teach numerous years, and in particular the same subject, and I'm a great advocate of you staying at the same grade level, because your teaching becomes more and more full of life, more delectable, okay? It's got a more pleasing aroma as the years progress. Don't get frustrated if you don't have everything nailed the first year. Existing stories. There are superb stories out there that can complement many areas of study, be it science, history, Bible. They're wonderful. But collecting these stories is something that comes, once again, with time. And if you're teaching the same subject matter and you've internalized that matter, you have your antenna up for looking for wonderful material that will enhance your teaching. So over the years, I accumulated a lot of little short stories. And I love short stories because I can use a myriad of them to illustrate different points, different concepts that I want the students to remember. A longer work of literature, sometimes you get into it and it might illustrate a concept that you're going over with the kids, but you get to a new area of study and you wish you could pull in another work. Okay? So in the classroom, to enhance your teaching, I really do enjoy short stories. Now in sixth grade, we teach the Napoleonic Wars. And in the course of teaching the Napoleonic Wars, we talk about the perilous nature of a sailor at sea during combat. How incredibly dangerous it is to be on a warship and go up in very close proximity to another warship and unload your cannons right into the broadside. And you've got rigging coming down. You have huge splinters flying through the air. Blood coats the deck. It's very slippery. Very dangerous environment. And I want them to remember that. And I found a wonderful story by Victor Hugo called The Battle with the Cannon. And I read this every year with the kids, and they just love it because it's a beautiful description of the dangers at sea, but it's also wonderful writing. And I want my classroom to be a laboratory where the kids can just slather themselves and immerse themselves in words. I want them to play in words like a child might play in a sandbox. And this story is about what happens if a cannon breaks loose from its moorings on a ship. And this cannon weighs thousands of pounds in a very, very rough sea. A gun that breaks its moorings becomes suddenly some indescribable supernatural beast. It is a machine which transforms itself into a monster. The mass turns upon its wheels, has the rapid movements of a billiard ball, rolls with the rolling, pitches with the pitching, goes, comes, pauses, seems to meditate, resumes its course, rushes along the ship from end to end like an arrow, circles about, springs aside, evades, rears, breaks, kills, exterminates. It is a battering ram which assaults a wall at its own caprice. Moreover, the battering ram is metal. the wall wood. It is the entrance of matter into liberty. Kids, don't you love that? And I might say that again to the children. It is the entrance of matter into liberty. One might say that this eternal slave avenges itself. It seems as if the power of evil, hidden in what we call inanimate objects, finds a vent and bursts suddenly out. It has an air of having lost patience, of seeking some fierce, obscure retribution, nothing more unrelenting than this rage of the inanimate. The madman, moreover, the battering ram, is metal. The wall wood. It is the entrance of matter into liberty. Kids, don't you love that? And I might say that again to the children. It is the entrance of matter into liberty. One might say that this eternal slave avenges itself. It seems as if the power of evil, hidden in what we call inanimate objects, finds a vent and bursts suddenly out. It has an air of having lost patience, of seeking some fierce, obscure retribution, nothing more unrelenting than this rage of the inanimate. The mad mass has the bound of a panther, the weight of the elephant, the agility of the mouse, the stubbornness of the axe, the unexpectedness of the surge, the rapidity of lightning, and the deafness of the tomb. It weighs 10,000 pounds, and it rebounds like a child's ball. Its flight is a wild world. A wild world abruptly cut at right angles. What is to be done? How to end this? A tempest ceases. A cyclone passes. A wind falls. A broken mast is replaced. A leak is stopped. A fire dies out. But how to control this enormous brute of bronze? In what way can you attack it? You can make a mastiff hear reason. Astound a bull, fascinate a boa, frighten a tiger, soften a lion, but there is no recourse with that monster. A cannon let loose. You cannot kill it. It is dead. At the same time, it lives with a sinister life bestowed upon it by infinity. Now, I'll take probably about an hour to go through this, and we stop and we talk about the language, and we talk about figures of speech, metaphor and simile, personification. Just have a ball with it. Make a list of the vocabulary that we don't really understand, and we try to figure it out based on the context. And then I'll have the kids the next day. We'll go into court, and I'll have half the class prosecuting attorneys, the other half defense attorneys, and the sailor that failed to fasten down the chain that caused the cannon to break loose, he's on trial. And they have to write up a speech, about a two-page speech, to prosecute him to show that he is culpable. And, of course, the defenders try to show that he eventually jumps down there and secures the cannon. But this is after the cannon has done massive damage to the ship. And there's a good chance that the ship is going to go down as a result of it. And it's a great ending to the story because the sailor is awarded for his heroic actions. And so he is given a medal by the captain of the ship, and then subsequently the order is given by the captain and shoot this man for negligence of duty. And the last scene is the sailor falling into the ocean, and there is a hurricane on the horizon. And the story ends. Do you think the kids will ever forget the perilous nature of a sailor at sea? No. They will not. When I am teaching about guilt, in trying to convey to my students the danger of violating one of God's precepts and protecting your conscience because once you violate it, you do something very, very, very deplorable, something very major, your conscience will not let you forget it. Yes, you'll be forgiven in Christ, but there's always that reminder. It's like a cell phone constantly going off. Or, students, I never want you to forget this. So here's a metaphor. Here's an illustration of what guilt does to you. It's kind of like a beating heart. Boom, 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 boom. So I read them the telltale heart, because I never want them to forget what guilt does. And if you remember the telltale heart, the protagonist of the story kills an older man that has a blue eye and a cataract, and then he buries him underneath the floorboards of his home, and he's so satisfied with himself by doing this clever, dastardly deed that he actually puts the chair on top of the wooden planks when the police officers come over in response to somebody calling in and saying that there was a scream heard. Very reminiscent of Alfred Hitchcock's film, Rope, if you haven't seen that. Fantastic. No doubt I grew very pale, but I talked more fluently and with a heightened voice, yet the sound increased. And what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound, much as a sound as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I gasped for breath, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more vehemently, but the noise steadily increased. I arose and argued about trifles in a high key and with violent gesticulations, but the noise steadily increased. Why would they not be gone? I paced the floor to and fro with heavy strides, as if excited to fury by the observations of the men. But the noise steadily increased. Oh, God, what could I do? I foamed, I raved, I swore. I swung the chair upon which I had been sitting and grated it upon the boards. But the noise arose over all and continually increased. It grew louder, louder, and louder, and still the men chatted pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible that they heard not? Almighty God, no. They heard, they suspected, they knew. They were making a mockery of my horror. This I thought and this I think, but anything was better than this agony. Anything was more tolerable than the derision I could bear. Those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt I must scream or die, and now again, hark, louder, louder, louder. Villains, I shrieked, disassemble no more. I admit the deed, tear up the planks. Here, here is the beating of this hideous heart. Guilt. When they become teenagers or young men or women, and they think about maybe engaging in some sort of promiscuous activity, taking some illicit drugs because of collegiate peer pressure, might this story come back to them? I hope. The beating heart. So spontaneous hypotheticals, existing stories. But what? Oh, and this brings up a point. Faculty members need to share stories. You need to ask your fellow colleagues, do you have any great stories to illustrate this? This is what I'm teaching right now. And when you have one, share them. Share the wealth. When I finish today, you might just want to mingle around and say, I teach fifth grade. I teach the American Revolution. Got any stories? Okay. And like I said, there's stories to illustrate almost anything that you're teaching upon. You're teaching science. Modernity. Display, read a story by Nathaniel Hawthorne called The Birthmark, in which, the main character, the scientist, believes that everything on Earth can be perfected via science. And he's got a young wife who has a birthmark in the shape of a hand, and she's beautiful, except that one little blemish. And he proceeds to try to remove it, and in the end, he actually kills his beloved. Wonderful story. But what do you do if you can't? To illustrate the point. You're getting the wrong idea of me. Poe in sixth grade,
story by Hawthorne. But what do you do if you can't find a story? You can create a story around the facts that you want the children to remember. And this helps the students avoid falling into passive learning. Gregory, in his book, The Seven Laws of Learning, points out that there are three different types of learning: passive, active, and absorbed. And you can't always have children in the absorbed mode. But that doesn't mean we can't try. For example, if I am teaching about westward expansion, there's a number of points I want the students to remember. Here are the points. I want them to remember that with the completion of the American Constitution, people are flooding to the shores of America. The majority of America is still agrarian, and because of that, land is in great demand. And so land along the East Coast, specifically the Northeast, is inflating rapidly. Poor plowing techniques, not letting land rest, and limited crop rotation have worn out the land. It's another point I want them to remember. But land west of the Appalachian Mountains, the land of the Mississippi and Ohio river valleys, is fertile. And the land is cheap, flat, not a whole lot of stones, and the land is abundant. Many people from the Northeast begin to migrate west for these reasons. That's what I want the students to remember. So what I do is I illustrate a story around those facts, and I incorporate my students into my narrative. So I'll put on, you know, maybe my cowboy hat and take my overhead cart, and I've got a rolly chair, put that behind my overhead cart, and take out the power cord and use that as my reins, and start, you know, whipping my power cord, and ha, ha, and I incorporate the kids right away. Come on, John, get a move on. I want to get an early start. Going to be a lot of people headed west today on the Connecticut Road. Wagons going to be rumbling and creaking along the roads, carrying families and everything west. 500 or more families today. Look at all that dust rising up. Must be 50 families already on the road. Come on, John, get a load out. Where are the oxen? Where are the cows? They fix up to the wagon. John, I'm going to tan your hide. Of course, the students love that. I don't actually hit them, but... Kids, get on in the wagon. I hooked up a blanket, kind of like a hammock, for you youngins to travel in. It's going to be kind of like we're at sea. Then I head out. And I stop on the other side of the room, point to another student. Where am I going? West, following the trail west of the Ohio River. Ordinance of 1787 stated that when 60,000 people move into an area, a state will be formed. Well, why don't you leave? All the best farmland has been taken in New England. Ain't much left. Now that America has a constitution, people from all over the world are rushing to the land, to this land, the land of opportunity where a man can speak his mind and choose his own path. It doesn't have anything to do with what his daddy's name was or his grandfather's name was. They're coming from all over Europe. Those that have money, they're looking for one thing, land. And you know that there's just not enough to go around. You know that decent land is selling for? Well, I heard that old man Jenkins sold his farm for $50 an acre. Now, who has that type of money? But that's what happens to the price when everybody wants land. It skyrockets. And I need more land. I've got to grow more crops. I got 5 mouths to feed, and I can't afford to buy acreage. So I'm heading west. You come west, too. Soil here is done pluckered out. Farmer's been growing crops on it for many years without letting the soil rest. The good book says that you got to let it rest every 7 years, but they have totally been ignoring that. Yep. Shoot, we get worse and worse crops every year. Last year, I got a fourth of the corn my daddy did. Now, what am I going to pass on to my child? What kind of woman is going to want to marry my eldest son with a broken down farm and nothing to offer her? I've got to move west. on the other side of the Appalachians. That's the land, just like heaven. Flat, deep, black soil, hardly a stone to lift, clear the trees, and there'll be a whole new life. Now go on and finish that lesson. And at the end of it, I would ask the students, okay, what did you learn about how the Constitution affected people immigrating to the United States? What was the impetus for people leaving the Northeast? What was attracting them? And invariably, they'll come up with a point that I want them to remember. And then I'll probably write those points on the board. And then, maybe a week later, I'll have them write an essay. And, you know, it might be a 5-paragraph essay, and I'll kind of outline it with them, all about what caused people to go west, what attracted them to go west, what were the, you know, potential dangers going out there. And they have the information to call, to draw from. And they have that mechanism of a story to help them recall the facts. And that is how you can use stories to enhance your teaching. Thank you.